even if Carlos was a bit too preoccupied with whatever science was, and Cecil was a bit too enthusiastic sometimes about, well, everything. The fact that Carlos was an outsider to Night Vale was unusual as well. Night Vale doesn't bring in a lot of new residents, and most people born there never leave. Everyone liked Carlos, as they liked most out-of-towners, or interlopers, the affectionate nickname Night Valians shout while pointing when they see someone unfamiliar in the street. He was likable enough, good-looking enough, and smart enough to be reprehensible, but despite all of these things, no one feared or distrusted his clever science or perfect hair. Because Cecil talked openly on his radio show about Carlos, their relationship was a point of near constant discussion in Night Vale. All of their imperfections and faults, which made them individuals worth loving. They had built those faults into the usual messy, comfortable, patched-up, beautiful structure that any functioning long-term relationship ended up being. This, the idea of relationships bit, was all conjecture on her part. She herself felt too young to try to figure out her own life, let alone someone else's life near hers, and so she had never even sought out companionship of that type. Jackie thought about dating from time to time in the distant way a person thinks about eventually becoming famous, or owning a castle, or growing ram's horns. They're all achievable, realistic goals, but by turning objectives into mere fantasies, she never had to go through the trouble of achieving or maintaining them. She occasionally found herself thinking about love when staring at the many twinkling spy satellites in the night sky, or when the wind tasted like sour peaches for no understood reason, or when she said a word that seemed different than a word she would ever say. Then she would wonder what it might be like to join her life with someone, or even just a few minutes with someone, just a touch or a glance, just anything, just something. "I'd like to meet someone special someday," Jackie thought. "King City," the paper in her hand said. Jackie crumpled the paper against the steering wheel. She hadn't been completely aware she was driving. She pulled into a strip mall that only had two businesses, Carlos's lab and Big Rico's Pizza. Big Rico's had struggled ever since wheat and wheat byproducts had been declared illegal. This was the result of a long and not terribly interesting story, but the gist is that wheat and wheat byproducts transformed first into snakes, then into evil spirits, resulting in a number of dead citizens. Jackie parked the car on asphalt that had been lifted into sharp undulations by the roots of a nearby tree, which was transformed by the tires of her slowing car into a disquieting thumping that did nothing to improve her mood. Carlos's lab was on the outskirts of the Science District, which was a pretty run-down part of town. There were a few new laboratories being built, but the science community did not like gentrification, so they resisted new money, holding tight to their history and culture. It was not uncommon for a single block to have not only marine biologists, but also quantum physicists living next door to each other. In many other cities, this may seem like the makings of a civil disaster, but Night Vale's science district really made it work. There were certainly some major disagreements and highly public conflicts between, say, the astronomers and the ornithologists, neither of which considers the other a real science. It's difficult sometimes for two scientific groups to get on well when the core tenet of one science is to disprove the existence of another science, such as it is with meteorologists and geologists. Carlos's lab was helpfully labeled with a simple illuminated yellow and black lab sign and a handwritten "We Are Open" sign in the front window. The door was unlocked and led first into a small waiting room, like a doctor's office, but with fewer deadly traps. She passed through it into the lab itself. Carlos and his team of five scientists were huddled around a table. There were rows of beakers around them, all bubbling, and a chalkboard covered in numbers, and also the word science in different fancy cursives. Some of the iterations had pink chalk hearts around them. It was much like any university-level science lab. "Excuse me?" Jackie said. None of the scientists noticed her. They were all writing busily on clipboards and wearing lab coats. This is called doing an experiment. She walked up to see what they were experimenting on. Under some work lights was a pink plastic flamingo. "Careful now," Carlos was saying. "We don't know what this or anything else does." The scientists nodded in unison and scribbled on their clipboards. "We understand very little." More nodding, more scribbling. "Excuse me, Carlos?" she said. He turned. There really was something blindingly handsome about him. His hair, maybe, or his demeanor. People are beautiful when they do beautiful things. Perhaps he had spent most of his life doing beautiful things, and it had really stuck. He smiled. He had teeth like a military cemetery. "Jackie, hello! I'm sorry, I was doing science." He waved over at the flamingo. "This is all very sciencey stuff. Just here is an equation," he said, indicating some numbers on the chalkboard. "It's important to have equations." "I see that. How's Cecil?" "Overenthusiastic, consumed with his work, has very little understanding of science. I love him a lot, the usual." The scientists nodded and wrote on their clipboards. All information was important information, even if the reasons were not immediately apparent. The reason for anything was rarely immediately or even eventually apparent, but it existed somewhere, like a moon that had escaped orbit and was no longer a moon, but just a piece of something that once was, spinning off into the nothing. The scientists were just then writing down that very metaphor. Metaphors are a big part of science. "I need your help, Carlos." "Jackie, there's little I love more than helping people. Science and Cecil are about it. But I'm in the middle of an important experiment, and I think if we just push through, we might figure out why the experiment is important. Finding out why we are doing what we already were doing is an exciting moment, and I believe we may be almost there." "All right, dude, but..." "Besides, Josie asked us to look at this, and I owe her a few. More than a few. I owe her, I don't know, a high number. I would express it as an equation, but it's all figurative, and figurative math is really tricky." "Carlos, look." She held up her left hand. The scientists all waited with pencils hovering, unsure of what observations they should be making at that moment. She did all her tricks with the slip of paper. She tossed it on the ground, tore it into pieces, flung it onto a Bunsen burner. Hell, she ate it. Why not? Each trick ended the same way, with her holding the uncreased paper back in her left hand, where it had never really left. Carlos dropped his clipboard. "You too?" he said. "Me too? Let me see that." He took the slip of paper and examined it closely. When he let go, it was back in her hand. The scientists were staring, mouths open. Their clipboards were at their sides. One of them appeared to have overloaded and shut down completely. Carlos rushed around the lab, turning on and off burners and throwing switches frantically. The other scientists helped the one scientist reboot. "We start immediately," Carlos shouted. "Oh, good," she shouted back. "Why are we shouting?" 12. Here is what we know so far. The composition of the graphite is what you would expect to find in graphite. The composition of the paper is exactly what you would expect in paper. All the parts are as we suspected, even as the whole astonishes. it does not appear to be physically dangerous. Mentally, it exerts a hold stronger than even the fascination with its properties could explain. After all, and I speak as someone who came here for what was supposed to be only a short research fellowship with the local community college, this town is mostly made of the unexplained. Sorry, I'm getting distracted. Also, can you stop throwing the paper at me? I know it never actually reaches me, but it's still unnerving, and I'm helping you out here. Thank you. I'm sorry if I snapped. It's okay to say I did. No, it's okay. King City is a small town of a little over 10,000 people in Monterey County. You can see pictures of it online. Just search any phrase at all in image search, and a picture of it will always be the first result. There doesn't appear to be anything unusual about it, any more than any other place where people live their unusual lives. You are not the first I've seen with these slips of paper. It's not important who else. It's important to them, but not to you. I haven't thought much about it, so I guess not important to me either. I just assumed it was another passing strangeness that would take care of itself before Cecil even finished the broadcast day of reporting on it. But it's been a few weeks now, and I didn't realize the paper did that. I wonder what else it does. You've reported feeling like your life is different since getting the paper. Like you are not yourself anymore, and the past is not your past, and the future you planned is now impossible. This is a common feeling, usually felt when we first wake up, or when we receive thoughts that do not seem to be our own while showering. But with that feeling sustained as long as it has been, and the start of it aligning exactly with your receiving of the paper, it is safe to say that the two are connected. Here, look at this equation. I have no idea what it means. It's really long, though. I'm going to add a couple more variables. Great. That looks really great. Nilanjana, please add that to the chalkboard. The next obvious step would be to go visit King City itself. See if all of this can be explained through simple physical proximity, or even if a slip of paper will react differently when it is proclaiming location rather than destination. Oh, and Nilanjana, draw another science with a heart around it, please. Put that next to the new equation. Thank you, Nils. But getting to King City is not as easy. Getting anywhere from Night Vale is a little tricky, as we have a vast desert around us, and our reality does not seem to align exactly with the reality of the rest of the world. But King City is an especially difficult case. Look at this map. Stan, can you please put the map up on the projector? No, wrong slide. That's the picture of a bee with a label saying Blood Oath. That goes with the apiology project. Yes, the next three slides as well. There's some free writing I did about bees. That's why they're labeled research notes. Okay, yes, good. There's the map. So this is a map of our region, with all roads and highways, and I want to show you all something. Let's start here with a laser pointer and try to make our way from Night Vale to King City. Head out on Route 800, and then turn here, and then merge with this, but oops, we missed it. So we go back, maybe try cutting across on this little mountain road. You believe in mountains, right? Not everybody does. Either way, we end up miles away. You see? None of the roads connect. It is like they are two entirely different road systems that seem like they should connect, but never do. Here, this next slide even brings us down to the level of horse and hiking trails, small ranch roads, stuff like that. I won't try to trace it all out now, but believe me, there is no sequence of walking or driving or any other kind of transportation that would take us from here to King City. Even though, and this is very strange, we could easily follow any number of roads to get to, say, Soledad, just a few miles down the highway from our target. Okay, so easy enough. Now that you got to Soledad, just head down the highway to King City. Well, if you're starting in Soledad, you can do that. But if you start tracing the roads all the way back in Night Vale, then by the time you get to Soledad, you can't find any way to get to King City. Scientifically speaking, wow. Big wow. This makes no sense, right? Do you think this makes no sense? Everyone nod if this makes no sense. Everyone's nodding? See, we are all in agreement that it makes no sense. But this is all laboratory work. And what does lab work tell you? Almost everything. Labs are very important. Something is wrong with King City. That's the most scientific answer I could give you. And I think that it would be dangerous to go, which you couldn't do anyway. But even the attempt might do irrevocable harm to your person or to the consciousness within your person. Not recommended. You might try talking to our mayor. She's had some experience with other worlds. I can't think of anyone else who has. Besides, of course, me. I've had extensive experience, but I don't like talking about myself. It's personal and not scientific. Most people don't leave here. Most people only come and then stay and stay and stay. Honestly, I have no idea how long I've been here. Time doesn't work here and all that. But not long enough. I haven't stayed long enough. Oh, sorry, I have to go, or you have to go. I'm going to stay here. This is my place of business. But it's just that Cecil's show is almost on, and I never miss it. No, I think I haven't stayed long enough at all, Carlos said. 13. The moonlight all-night diner along Route 800 served okay coffee, okay pies. Some of the pies and coffee were invisible, and for the people who liked invisible pie or invisible coffee, this was a real plus. Here's what. If you like a thing, and only one place in town serves that thing, you're going to be pretty excited by that thing, regardless of quality. So for people who like invisible pie, the invisible pie at the Moonlight All Night was perfect, despite being just okay. Diane did not like invisible pie. Her friend on the PTA, Steve Carlsberg, was one of those people who championed the unpopular dessert. "It's an underappreciated pie, Diane," Steve would sometimes say between bites. "You develop a taste for it like you do with Scotch whiskey, or cilantro, or a salt lick." Diane remained unconvinced. Her issue was not with flavor, the pie had none, but with texture, it had none. But Diane was not at the Moonlight with Steve now. She was there to meet Dawn. They rarely interacted at work, and even less often outside of work. There were lots of reasons for this, none of them interesting. Not everybody gets to be friends with everybody. Diane was not friends with many people. She had drifted apart from her childhood and teenage friends because of age and changing circumstance, and the high rate of mysterious disappearance and death in Nightvale. In her mid-twenties, she found herself at the funeral of what was her last remaining childhood friend, Cynthia Yin, whom she had met in music censorship class in third grade, and who had survived 3 UFO attacks, a year's incarceration by the city council for voting incorrectly in a municipal election, and a direct encounter with a pack of street cleaners, only to die of liver cancer, which had gone undiagnosed for over a year. And she wondered whether it was worth it to have friends, to make any connections at all when the world so easily took them from her. Since then, she had continued making friends, but they all, like Steve, were friends of circumstance. The people she worked with in the PTA, regulars here at the Moonlight, even the people and sentient patches of haze who often walked the same evening neighborhood route as she did, which was more of a distant nodding relationship than a friendship, but whose names she knew. A few of them had even whispered some interesting secrets to her as they passed. Mostly, she contented herself with Josh, who was not a friend, and was often not even friendly, but who filled her life until it couldn't fit much else. She looked with excitement and unease to the day when he would grow old enough that her heart could empty a bit of him, and there would be a space left where someone else could fit, although she couldn't imagine who. Anyway, Dawn was late. This was fine with Diane. Laura, one of the regular waiters, was standing over a table, long leafy plants growing from her chest and arms and neck. The diners plucked the fruits from her branches, looking at each bright bulb for dents, smelling them for ripeness. Diane had written down some things to talk to Dawn about. She wanted to know the obvious. How have you been? How's the family? Do you have a family? Written in parentheses, as Diane did not want to presume that everyone has a family. How are you? Name every person you've ever worked with, and so on. But this was all leading up to the real reason for their conversation. Evan. Was his name Evan? She looked at her notepad. Evan, it said in an unfamiliar hand. Evan, Diane said aloud. Hey, Diane. Laura shouted across the way, a family of five yanking blackberries and tomatoes from her sides. Good to see you again. Somebody'll be with you in a minute, all right? Diane smiled and waved. Laura was bleeding along her wooden limbs. The diner stopped taking the food from her and stared in discomfort. Oops, sorry about that. Let me get you another server. Be right back. Laura bled her way toward the kitchen. A branch caught on a sink and snapped off. Laura began to weep, still making her way toward the coffee machine, her face growing paler and paler as the stump of the branch spurted blood onto the coffee cups. Oh, jeez, she said, tears falling from her face and landing like dew on her already blood-spotted leaves. Clumsy me, just a real Sally knock-em-down. A blonde man wearing a white apron, handsome in all of the expected ways, and in this way almost forgettable, followed behind her carrying a tray of used dishes. As he rounded the corner of the table, Diane saw it was Troy. Diane got to her feet before she even knew that was what she was going to do. He did not look at her. He trotted with his dishes. She thought she was going to say something, but she didn't know what to say, so she just followed him. It was definitely Troy. Would she follow him into the kitchen? She wouldn't know until the moment came. He was nearing the swinging silver door, and they were well past the restroom arrow sign, well past the point where her presence could be excused, and still she hadn't said anything to him. The man, and now she was starting to feel unsure that it was Troy, maybe just a man who looked similar, or even a man who didn't look that similar at all, turned around to face Diane. As he pressed his back against the door to open it, he looked at her. "Excuse me," Diane said, much louder than she had intended. "Is this the restroom?" He said nothing. The door swung shut, then open, in smaller and smaller increments. The man who looked like Troy was gone. "What are you doing, Diane?" It was Laura. She was not smiling. Her branches were still bleeding a little onto the floor. "Nothing, I just... restrooms are back that way." Diane pointed at the door to the kitchen. "Nope, back that way," Laura said, her face giving nothing away but bland service industry congeniality. Diane walked toward the restroom, but she did not need to use it, so she just slowed her way back into the restaurant and past the coffee counter, glancing into the kitchen area. She couldn't see anyone in it. "They're right over there, Diane," Laura said from across the room. She pointed with a leafy arm, her face no longer congenial, her eyes unmoving, unmoved. Diane turned and went into the restroom. She stood in front of the mirror for a minute, her hands gripping either end of the sink. It had been Troy. She knew it. Or, well, maybe it hadn't been. And anyway, she was here to find out about... Ethan? Ellen. She couldn't remember the name. Nothing about herself seemed certain. She shouted into the sink. It did nothing in response. She shouted again, wondering if the people out in the dining room could hear her. No one came in, anyway. She wasn't sure she had even been shouting out loud, or if she had only thought about shouting. Her throat felt raw. She ran the sink, and then the hand dryer, and then returned to her booth. Dawn was there. "The waiter told me you were in the restroom. She said to have a seat. Sorry I'm late." "Hi, Dawn. It's good to see you." Her throat was tight and sore as she spoke, and she tried to make her voice sound normal. "What's this?" Dawn grabbed the notepad Diane had left sitting on the tabletop. "No, you don't have to..." Diane started. "It's just some things..." Dawn grinned as she read it. "Well, first off, I am fine. How are you? Do you have a pen?" Diane indicated the pen next to the salt, pepper, and sand shakers. "Ah, great." Dawn took it and checked off the questions as she answered them. "The family's great. My sister is pregnant. My father retired and is making hammocks. As a hobby, you understand. He's made thousands, leaving them in a giant pile on his front lawn. The neighborhood association is upset because they think it's a political statement, some kind of conceptual art installation about the existence of mountains." "Yikes, that's very controversial," said Diane, finding a gap in the conversation she could work her voice into. "I mean, I believe in mountains and all, but I understand it's a controversial viewpoint. I would never force that viewpoint on others." "Right, well, that's not what he's trying to do at all. Don't get down on my dad. You don't know him. He just likes making hammocks and then putting them in a pile. That's something he's always loved." "I'm sorry, that's not what I meant. I'm glad your father is happy." "He says kids come by sometimes trying to steal hammocks from his pile to hang between two trees and lie on. He manages to chase most of those vandals away. He acts irritated when he talks about it, but between you and me, I think he likes the challenge." Dawn checked the next thing off the list and added, "Yes, I have a family. It might have made more sense to put that first." Diane didn't think that anything about today was likely to make sense. She felt nauseous after that moment in the restroom and was extra glad she hadn't ordered any food, invisible or not. "I'm feeling okay," Dawn said, pen over the next question. "I had a migraine recently, although of course I didn't know until someone told me." "Of course," said Diane. "Why of course?" "Also about a food poisoning. Had to miss a couple of days." "You got a migraine from food poisoning?" "What? No. How would that happen? It was just food poisoning. We have the salmon delivery man come every Tuesday and leave fresh salmon on our porch. Lately, the quality seems to be deteriorating. He used to put an entire live fish there and lumber away. We'd open the door and find a wet creature with panicked, unblinking eyes flopping around outside our door. We'd kill it with strychnine and have delicious steaks and salads and pastas. But lately, he's just been leaving wet piles of torn, pinkish-gray flesh that I hope is salmon. Honestly, I think he's just tossing it from the sidewalk, not even walking up to the porch anymore." "I've never heard of any kind of meat causing food poisoning, just wheat and its byproducts." "Well, me neither, of course, but after we ate this week's salmon delivery, and it was especially moist and spongy this week, Stuart and I both felt a bit sick. We couldn't get out of bed for days." "Is Stuart your husband?" Diane asked.
"Who?"
"Stuart."
"Who is Stuart?"
"You just said his name is Stuart, the man you live with?"
"I live alone, Diane, single as can be."
Diane suddenly felt like the words she was saying were twisting in her mouth and coming out as different words altogether. No part of the conversation was connecting with any other part. She might throw up after all, but she had just been in the restroom. It would look strange to run back to it so soon. The thought of that slight embarrassment kept her stomach in check. "Who did you eat that salmon with the other night?"
"Nobody, just me. Like I said, this is my first time out with someone else in over a month, I think. So glad you invited me."
"Right. I'm glad you agreed to meet me." A gray-gloved hand rose over the edge of the table, holding two coffees. It quietly slid them in front of the two women. They pretended they did not see the hand, maintaining eye contact and waiting in polite silence as it pushed food they had never actually ordered onto the table.
a Greek salad for Diane, and a Denver omelet for Dawn. The hand made a subtle flourish of accomplishment and then disappeared back under the table. This is about... Dawn looked back at Diane's list. Evan? Diane moved the Greek salad away from her, one hand on her stomach. Yes, I remember working with Evan. I remember him going missing from our office the same time you were out sick. He called me the day you came back, and when I went to his cubicle, where I was certain he worked, there was no cubicle there, just a plant and a photo and a chair. Dawn's mouth was full of omelet. She seemed very hungry. It must have been the recovery from the food poisoning. And neither you nor Catherine remember anyone named Evan working with us? I'm sorry I don't, Dawn said, having swallowed the mouthful of egg. Diane felt a surge in the back of her mouth and had to take a moment to keep herself together. It's just that, she said after that moment, how can you sit so close to where someone worked and have no recollection of them? Well, Diane, you didn't call in. Catherine had some of us ready to go to your house to find you, Dawn. But then you get back to work and Catherine is like, no, I was totally in the know. And you were like, yeah, just food poisoning. But I'm telling you, the feeling around the office before you came back was that you and Diane glanced at her notepad. Evan were both missing. We almost had to get the sheriff's secret police involved. Dawn set the pen down and slid the notepad back to Diane. Her lips were stern and thin and had a bit of egg on them. Diane, tell me what you remember about this Evan.
I remember working with him for years.
Did he like sports?
I don't know.
Movies? TV shows? Books? Certain types of dogs? What kind of clothes did he wear?
I remember a tan jacket.
What else? What color shirts? How tall was he? Was he married? How old was he? What's a memorable thing he once did? Did he ever tell you a joke? Or maybe he had some insight during a meeting? What department did Evan work in, Diane?
A long pause became a short pause, became a quick beat, became nothing.
I don't want to make you seem crazy, Diane. I really don't. Listen, I'm just happy to have a friend to hang out with. I can't remember the last time I hung out with somebody, but I can tell you there was never an Evan at our office.
Dawn's face was flushed, and she was breathing hard. She seemed furious, but it might have just been the food poisoning. Diane saw the familiar blonde man ducking under the counter. She counted slowly to 10, but the man did not come back up. Maybe she hadn't seen anything. Maybe she had come into existence seconds ago and had made up every moment until this moment to explain how she came to be sitting in this booth in this diner. Dawn took a sip of her coffee to cover the silence, which went longer than either of them had anticipated, so the sip ended up draining her mug. She set down the empty mug and wiped coffee and egg off her mouth. Sometimes the only things we can know for sure are the things we feel. I believe you, Diane. I disagree with you, but I believe you. Diane felt a gentle hand touch her own, a sympathetic pat. Dawn had both hands on her coffee cup. Diane looked back down at her own hand and saw the final quick motion of a gray-gloved hand disappearing under her table.
14. Jackie felt, as the door swung her back out onto the sun-cracked asphalt, that science had taught her little. Carlos had suggested seeing the mayor. It would mean going to City Hall, which would put her in dangerous proximity to the city council, but the mayor herself was a comforting figure, and probably safe enough. City Hall was certainly better than where old woman Josie wanted her to go. Anywhere was better than the library. She sauntered to her car, not in any hurry to leave the mild warmth of the evening sunlight. The desert beyond the roads and buildings was going pink at the edges, orange farther in,
and then a deep yellow glow where the setting sun met the horizon. It was all very pretty to look at, and so she did. As a result, she did not notice what was in her car until it grabbed her as she opened the door.
"Erica, you scared the shit out of me!"
Jackie had to intentionally restart her breathing. The impossibly tall being, seemingly made of bright black beams of light, shrugged, and there was the flutter of hundreds of tiny wings all beating at once. Fear is a reasonable response to life. Jackie didn't have time for general philosophizing from a being it was illegal to acknowledge existed. Or maybe she did have time. She wasn't about to pretend she understood anything at all about time.
"You're in my car, so explain why, or get out."
Erica turned to look at her. Where eyes might be on a human being was a shadowy glow that Jackie could taste in the back of her mouth. It tasted like strawberry candy covered in mud. "I come with a message on behalf of the angels. We are afraid. All of us. I am perhaps the most afraid." Jackie forced herself to meet Erica's gaze directly, or as directly as she could given she could not locate their eyes.
"Is that message supposed to be useful to me?"
"It is not supposed to be anything. It is just a message. Messages are for the sender, not the receiver."
"Then, dude, I hope it helped you out, telling me that. I really do hope that, but could you get out of my car? Or else you're going to end up at City Hall, because that's where I'm going."
The fluttering of wings again. A soft voice singing somewhere far above them. Erica shrugged. "Actually, I could use a ride. Do you mind?"
"Do you have gas money?"
Jackie wadded up the piece of paper in her left hand and threw it into Erica's chest. It bounced to the window and then back down into Erica's lap.
"I am afraid of this piece of paper," said Erica.
"King City," said the paper.
"Even angels are afraid," said Jackie.
Erica stared blankly into a blank lap. Several listening antennas on nearby rooftops swung around to point at the car. A small, blinking light on the dashboard repeated the warning, "Angel acknowledged." Jackie pushed the reset button to turn it off.
"Sorry, I meant even you are afraid," she articulated loudly for the listening devices. "Seriously, do you have gas money?"
"There was a time where I was extremely wealthy. One of the most wealthy people. But angels don't use money, as they keep telling me over and over."
Erica folded their hands in their lap.
"Figures. All right, Erica. Let's go."
She started the car, somehow, even though nothing about the engine should have started.
"Rocks! This is just a bag of rocks,"
her mechanic had muttered during her last scheduled maintenance, tears running down his face. As she pulled the car out, Erica pointed into the desert.
"Behold."
Out amidst the spectrum of sunset, the giant glass building had returned. There were others with it. A multitude of glass specters, and bubbles of light with a source that did not seem to be the rapidly departing sun. The voices of a crowd chanting something just on the edge of intelligible came with it.
"So," said Jackie, continuing to navigate out of the parking lot, "sometimes in my mirror I see brief flashes of a faceless old woman. These things happen."
"Not these things," said Erica. "This is all wrong. We are worried about old woman Josie. We are worried for her. I am terrified. I am terrified."
A few of their long hands were rubbing together.
"I'm sure there's nothing to be terrified of about visions in the desert. It's just our eyes lying to us. Every part of our bodies lies to us constantly. Didn't you ever take a health class in elementary school?"
Jackie said. Erica turned in their seat to keep whatever they passed as eyes on the spot in the desert
where the lights had been, until the desert was no longer visible. They turned back. There was a comfortable quiet between Erica and Jackie, only breaths and breeze and faint traffic. After a few moments of this, Jackie asked, "So seriously, man, no gas money?" "All right. I think I have maybe 10 bucks, said the angel. 15. "What are you looking for?" Dawn asked to the back of Diane's head. Diane stopped. She had felt fine a second ago, but now a sharpness of nerves hit her chest. She knew how this looked, crouched low, lifting up the trash can in the custodial closet near the office elevator. "I lost something last week, a slip of paper." "They'd have already taken last week's trash." "I know, I just thought maybe it had fallen out. Loose paper. Never mind." Diane stood. She was significantly taller than Dawn, at least 5 inches taller. Diane did not see herself as taller. "What did you lose? Maybe I can help." Diane hadn't exactly avoided Dawn since their conversation at the Moonlight All-Night Diner, but she had allowed the natural processes of work to wear away any bridge that might have been formed between them. She was okay with distance. She was okay with being a stranger. And thinking about that day at the diner brought back the nausea. The egg on Dawn's lip, the two realities in Dawn's stories, and the blood dripping from Laura's branches. Dawn's face made her dizzy with memory. "No, it's fine. It's fine. It was a small piece of paper. Like a receipt." "Yeah, but with handwriting, I think."
"So, a note?"
"Yeah, a note."
"What did the note say?"
Diane was unintentionally not breathing. When she noticed, she started breathing again.
"It's fine. You don't have to tell me."
"King City," Diane said without knowing how she knew to say it. "King City."
"I think it said King City in pencil, all caps."
"That's all it said?"
"Yes, it just said King City."
Dawn stared at her, and Diane didn't know what else to say.
"I don't know how to help you, Diane,"
Dawn said, a perfect mix of confused and disappointed, and went back to her desk. Diane stayed at work, not working on work, as everyone else left. Dawn, Catherine, the men all named Sean who worked in sales, Peter, Celia, Maya, Martellus, Ricardo, and Tina. Once everyone was gone, she logged onto Tina's computer. As something of a party trick, she was excellent at guessing passwords based on a person's personality, and had long ago correctly guessed that Tina's password was "Who am I really?" followed by 19 question marks, and looked up the office phone records. She glanced up every few moments to make sure no one was coming back for a forgotten jacket, or to use the bloodstone circle at the office so they didn't have to wait until home to use one. But the office was silent. She felt the silence more than heard it. In her tension, it had become tactile. There was no record of people who called into the office, only outgoing calls, so that was no good. She then searched the payroll folders for all staff lists. Any sign of someone named... Diane could not remember who she was looking for. Evan. She was looking for Evan. Diane grabbed blank paper from Tina's printer and wrote "Evan" in pencil, all caps, and slid it into a new manila folder. A search of Tina's computer came back with no Evans. It found some usage of "grievances" in a folder titled HR, and several usages of "relevant" in Tina's email program. No Evan. Diane walked around the empty office again to reassure herself that it was empty. She imagined being watched. At Dawn's computer, password "all is loss," Diane opened the web browser and typed in the address of every phone provider she could think of.
Two letters into her third guess, the browser autofilled the address of a login screen. When she hit enter, the browser had already filled in a username and password. Diane logged into Dawn's phone account as Dawn. She looked up recent call history and found the four dates Dawn was gone, but no record of her calling the office. Of course, this did not mean Dawn did not have another phone at home. Diane tried looking up more phone and cable providers. There were no other autofills. Outside Catherine's office, Diane gripped the doorknob, but it did not turn. She stared at the brushed nickel knob. She was not at all the type of person to break into her boss's office. Or rather, as it turned out, she was that type of person, but she had never considered herself that type of person. The type to do anything that anyone might consider wrong, or that anyone might report to a local government agency or amateur surveillance club. She was responsible and quiet, she thought, as she quietly started on the responsibility of getting through the door. She first imagined the old trick from television where a detective pops a lock with a credit card. Then she imagined having the power to walk through walls and, by extension, doors. Then she imagined being a professional locksmith, with a small backpack full of short wires that she would shove carefully into a standard lock, grease smudges on her knuckles and face, a cold, concentrated look in her eye, and a plastic-handled screwdriver hanging by its flat-headed tip from her teeth. Then Diane imagined that a custodian probably keeps keys. Inside the unlocked custodial closet, Diane found a metal cabinet. Inside the unlocked metal cabinet, Diane found a cluster of keys, a jangling rat king on a yellow rubber coil. Outside Catherine's office, Diane imagined that she would just know the right key, and it would be the first key. Diane imagined the same thing with the second key, and the third through 13th keys. As she did, she imagined being watched. She looked up after every key, but there was no one. The bloodstone circle hummed a familiar melody in the corner. On the 13th key, the knob turned. There was a moment. The door was open but unstepped through, where Diane thought that she could still walk away and not become a person who had broken into anywhere in her life. But then she stepped forward and became that person forever. She shut the door, made sure the blinds were closed, and sat in the chair with wheels at Catherine's desk. Catherine's computer didn't have a password. It just had the question, "Are you Catherine?" with yes and no buttons. Diane clicked the yes button, and the desktop blinked up. She ran a search for the name Evan. She got similar results to what she'd gotten on Tina's computer. She found no Evan as a name or former employee. She searched for emails related to Dawn to see if there was any mention of Dawn's absence, any unusual notes. Diane imagined she was a hacker, not an actual master of programming languages and network security, but a hacker from a movie, wildly typing, every finger expertly leaping from key to key as a long string of important secrets streamed down the screen in old-fashioned computerized font. Her eyes flicking left and right, taking in every number and letter and significant bit of information. She imagined finding more than nothing. She felt a light itch on the hand holding the mouse. In the mild glow of the computer screen was the tarantula, one leg up on her little finger. The tarantula paused as if it was hesitant to move farther into Diane's physical space. She spasmed a bit out of shock, but then settled down when she was able to process it. She would not have minded it, as Josh often appeared as any variety of arachnid, so she had no fear of spiders or most insects. She found it sweet that the animal appeared to be so shy or considerate. In actuality, the tarantula saw large blocks of moving colors and shapes and sensed it had made contact with a creature much larger than itself. It felt great fear, and was holding still out of the, "if you move, you will be seen, and if you are seen, you will be eaten" instinct. Diane continued looking up previous agendas and minutes from staff meetings. The tarantula took her movement as a threatening advance and scuttled away into the dark of the office. Diane imagined finding great clues. She imagined film noir, dim but high contrast light pressing through the blinds, creating smoky white slices across the pitch black room. Diane imagined her face lit softly in blue by the computer monitor. She imagined not her own face, but the face of a hardened detective wearing an archetypal hat. She imagined being watched. She heard a soft thump from over her shoulder. She felt a warning zing up the back of her neck. She was being watched. She did not turn her head. She did not move. She looked only with her eyes, pressed so far to the right it hurt her sinuses. There was a shadow against the blinds. The blinds were closed. There was a person just on the other side. The person was neither tall nor short. She did not know if the person could see her. They were not leaving. "If you are seen, you will be eaten," the tarantula thought without human vocabulary. Diane was unintentionally not breathing. When she noticed, she continued to hold her breath. Her hands stayed where they were. There was a rapid clicking. The doorknob rattled back and forth. She couldn't remember if she had locked it. She was eventually going to have to breathe. The doorknob rattled. She breathed. Her breath sounded so loud. Was it always this loud? The computer flashed to a screensaver. She did not know if this change in light was visible through the blinds. Again, the doorknob rattled. Then a knock. Another. Three hard taps on the door. There was nothing she could do. She stayed where she was, did nothing. The shadow returned to the window and stayed for a long moment. She didn't know how long the moment was. It felt endless to her, motionless in the chair. Then the shadow blurred as its source moved away from the window. Light began to come in around the blind's edges. She heard a muffled creaking, like wheels. Wheels on a cart. A custodial cart. The sound moved away down the hall. Diane imagined that custodians worked long hours and would not be out of the office for some time. Hours, maybe. She turned off the computer monitor and waited in Catherine's office, quietly, alone, breathing. The Voice of Night Vale. Allergies to shellfish, dislike of shellfish, apathy to shellfish, philosophical disagreement with shellfish, or a general uncertainty about the whole concept of shellfish should let the event planners know when making their reservation. And now, a word from our sponsors. We know that sometimes in life, you find yourself with nothing to do but wait. Maybe you have hours to wait. Maybe you have hours to wait, hiding in a darkened office until the custodian leaves so that you won't be caught snooping through confidential files at work. There's lots of reasons you could be waiting. It just happens to be that the reason you are waiting right now is that one. Yes, we know a lot about you. Wouldn't this period of malfeasant waiting be better if you were able to use it, say, catching up on the latest episodes of your favorite TV shows? Think how less boring illegally breaking into your boss's office would be if you were watching TV right now, Diane. We all thought better of you. Hulu Plus. Good for criminals. This has been a word from our sponsors. And now a word about librarians. We are all, from our youngest years, warned that the most dangerous, untrustworthy creature is that which stalks our public libraries. We all remember as children having this told to us by frazzled men in rumpled suits, clutching ancient tomes to their chests. Arr, they would say,
pointing at a diagram that was just a square with the word library written neatly in the middle of it. They would continue, pointing at the clearest photograph ever taken of a librarian, which is a blurry and badly burnt Polaroid. They would conclude, pointing at the first diagram again. It was always a very short presentation. Then the men would run from our classrooms, looking fearfully around and muttering, "There's no time, just no time," and never would be seen again. These warnings, as playfully conveyed as they were, are serious matters that should be applied to your grown-up, serious life. Librarians are hideous creatures of unimaginable power. And even if you could imagine their power, it would be illegal. It is absolutely illegal to even try to picture what such a being would be like. So just watch out for librarians, okay? And now, let's have a look at traffic. Here is a man with a new job. Here is a man. He has a new job. So new that he hasn't actually gone to it yet. He is now only in the process of going to it. It is his first day. Not as a human, but at this job. It is approximately his 10,000th day as a human. And yet, for all his days, he is not yet very good at being a human. He still makes a lot of mistakes. All that time, and he still is unsure of himself. He drives to his job. His car is nice, nicer than he can afford, but just as nice as he hopes he can soon afford. His car is aspirational. His gray pinstripe suit, his smile, his silver watch, the way he walks, these are all also aspirational. He doesn't think of himself as the him that exists in this moment, but as the him that will exist soon. He is not far away from the him that he really is. He will be that version of himself very soon. But then, he sees something. It doesn't matter what. It's someone dying. It's sudden, and not anyone's fault, but also could have been prevented. He is sitting in his nice car, and he sees this death. And he does not go to his new job. He never does. In fact, since he never actually goes to it, it is not accurate to call it his new job. It is the job he never had. It is a future that, like most futures, never happened. This has been Traffic. New statistics by the community activist group Citizens for a Transparent Government say that it is as difficult as it has ever been to get through City Hall alive and speak to Mayor Cardinal. That over half of citizens who have appeared before the City Council have been eaten by the Council. And that the government is still not transparent. "I can still totally see them," said Frankie Ramone, spokesperson for the group. "They're not even faint outlines in the air. They're still totally visible, totally opaque. It's like they're not even trying." Next, a sudden loss of consciousness followed by a waking as a new person, living a new life, but with all the same old questions unanswered. Starting in 1:2:16. Jackie dropped off Erica across the street from City Hall. It wasn't safe for Erica to exist in such close proximity to the source of city law. "Thanks," Erica said as they opened the car door. "Hey," said Jackie. "Don't worry about it. Thanks for the cash."
"You're a good one, Jackie Fierro," they said,
and that makes the world a dangerous place for you. There was that flutter of wings again, and a dark haze filled the air behind Erica. Once they had unfolded themselves from the car, they stood over 7 feet tall, much more than could have fit in Jackie's compact.